Welcome to Anthony Plog on Music. This is Eddie Ludema, the show's producer, introducing two outstanding young musicians who became good friends and recently graduated with bachelor's degrees at Juilliard, trombonist Carlos Jimenez Fernandez and trumpeter William Leathers. They both already have great jobs as principal players, with Will playing principal trumpet with the Nashville Symphony and Carlos playing principal trombone with the New York City Ballet. They've also performed with groups such as the New York Philharmonic, Philadelphia Orchestra, and London Symphony. In part one, Tony, Will, and Carlos get started by talking about Will and Carlos' path to Juilliard. Will raised enough money with the help of a GoFundMe campaign that a good friend set up for him, and Carlos was able to get a good scholarship. Then they talk about what their auditions were like to get into the school, and finally talk about their studies with their main teachers, Joe Alessi for Carlos and Chris Martin and Ray Mace for Will.
So Will Leathers and Carlos Jimenez Fernandez, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for having us.
I'm really happy to have you on. And I believe that the two of you met at Juilliard and played in a brass quintet together. So what I'd like to do is first ask you about your path to Juilliard, and then we can talk about Juilliard. And you both started early, Carlos. I think you started with euphonium at the age of 6, I think, and then trombone at the age of 8.
Right.
And Will with piano at the age of 4 and trumpet at the age of 7. So maybe we could start with that. I guess start with Will, since we'll start with treble clef and then we'll go to bass clef. And
sure.
Carlos, we'll get to you in just a second. So why did you choose piano and then trumpet after that? I think trumpet was because of your father.
Yeah, trumpet was because of my father. Well, I'll start with the piano story because that's how I initially got into music. I watched this cartoon growing up called Oswald, and that was all about a big blue octopus that played the piano. And so watching that all the time, I started to want to play piano. So I begged my mom, hey, can I start playing some piano? Can I get some lessons? I want to learn how to do that. I want to learn how to do what that octopus is doing. And so after about 6 months, she finally got me some piano lessons. And that's essentially where the work started on that instrument. And when it comes to the trumpet, pretty much ever since I was born, I would be listening to my dad practice every day in the house. He practices in the basement, and I can hear him wherever I am in the house, and I always loved hearing him play. And so I pretty much always wanted to play the trumpet as well, but my dad didn't. And my dad wanted to wait to get me started off just to make sure I had those 4 front adult teeth, so it's a little bit easier to set my embouchure up. And as a result, the structure of my embouchure largely hasn't changed much since I was 7 years old, all thanks to my dad just waiting a little longer. So that's how I got into both those instruments.
When I see pictures of you, your embouchure, it looks like you play a little bit more, what would you say, straight ahead than most players? Most players play with a slight downward angle, and it looks like you play fairly straight. Is that true?
I think so. Maybe straight forward and down a little bit, and then horizontally it's just slightly off to the left a little bit, but I think, you know, I just keep my head forward like that and elbows up, and then wherever the bell ends up, you know, I just want to be able to project enough when I play in any sort of situation. So
yeah.
Plus my dad was always on me saying, you know, keep your elbows up and you know, posture and all that. So I think all those things essentially contributed to where my bell is vertically and horizontally.
And Carlos, how was the euphonium when you started on that?
It was too big for me.
It was okay.
It was so big that, I mean, I started it when I was, you know, 6, so I was not a very big person. So I would have to be, I have to sit down in a chair and somebody had to hand me the euphonium so I could play. And that's how I practiced. That's how I did my lessons and all that. My path to that also started with the piano, but not by the way of lessons, but just because we had a piano at home. My dad had studied piano, and also my brother when they were both young. And so having the piano at home and hearing both of them play, I started doodling around with, you know, the early piano methods and whatnot. Eventually I asked to join the band, and that's where I started learning euphonium after a sort of brief stint with percussion, but very, very brief. I was more into a melodic instrument at the time. Because the type of percussion that bands usually do in Spain, or the ones that we that my band did, was just to prepare for the really long processional services. So it was essentially like playing the same rhythm over and over and over and over again for hours, which I, you know, didn't really find very exhilarating. Eventually, I started playing the euphonium, and after a couple years, it was time to enroll in what's called a conservatory system in Spain, and they didn't have euphonium. Very few places do, but they did have trombone. And from there, I was already sort of into the instrument because one of my good friends already played trombone, and I was like, "Oh, that looks cool, right?" So that's how I arrived at the trombone.
And could you reach seventh position if you're that small, or had you grown?
Not immediately. I definitely didn't. I started on a very small, you know, instrument without a valve or anything. So I remember I did reach sixth. I don't think I reached seventh from the beginning. I had to wait a little bit. Even now, I have to really think when I'm going down to seventh. I have to, like, you know, organize myself in a way that it's going to let me go there because my arms are really not that long.
Both of you are already at a really, really young age are in what most people would think the height of a career. And so you must have realized pretty early on that this is what you wanted to do, that you wanted to be in music. Do you remember, like, pretty much how old you were when you thought, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life?
For me, I think it was somewhere around the time when I was maybe 13 or 14. I don't remember specifically, like, you know, one day I woke up, I went to my parents, I want to be a musician. I don't remember it being like that. But it sort of grew organically. Again, you know, I started so young that I became, you know, more and more serious about it. But yeah, somewhere around that age probably for me.
How about you, Will?
Yeah, for me, it's I don't know if I can really pinpoint a place in my life where I thought this is what I want to do. It's just that as I got older, I started to gradually realize, you know, I have to do something to make a living later on. You know, as you get older, you start to understand how the adult world works. So it's like, well, I'm having fun doing this, so, you know, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing and live my adult life the same way I lived my childhood, essentially. Just having fun.
You know, there's an incredible video of you at maybe the age of 12 backstage with Wynton Marsalis. I don't know if you've seen that or not. And where he's talking to you, probably, and he takes a lot of time, you know, for a kid that he's just met, probably 15 or 20 minutes, and saying some really great things, you know, about always keep learning and keep growing and all of this, which was really inspiring to me. And another thing that I thought was so great that I think most people probably wouldn't recognize listening to that was somebody was holding the camera and occasionally would sort of be laughing in a way that sounded really proud. And to me, it sounded like it was your mother. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, my mother was behind the camera. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just projecting, but she sounded fantastic. She sounded so proud of you and so happy to be in that room. And so for me, you know, there's great wisdom coming from Wynton Marsalis, but just listening occasionally to your mom was great. That was the best part of the video for me.
Yeah, my favorite memory from that night, I don't know if it was a part of that video or not. I think my mom might have put the camera down by then, but I remember Wynton and my mom having a quick verbal interaction for a little bit. And then I remember my mother making a joke. She said, you know, sometimes I feel like I picked up the wrong baby from the hospital. And then Wynton just breaks out in complete laughter almost on the floor. That was
really?
That was my favorite part of the whole night.
Oh, that's great. Another thing that was amazing to me was he said, I know that your son has perfect pitch because of his hands. And he said,
yeah,
I can tell if somebody has perfect pitch because of the way their hands are formed.
Yeah, I got to talk to him and figure out what he was talking about, because I still don't know. It was something on the palm of my hand. I don't know. Carlos, you have perfect pitch, right?
Almost perfect.
Almost perfect?
So not 100%. Sometimes it deceives me sometimes.
Well, can you make any perfect pitch discrepancies on your palm in comparison to your colleagues that aren't blessed like you?
Well, I haven't paid that much attention to our palms, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, maybe you should pay attention next time someone next to you goes in the seventh position. Just take a quick look at that palm
right.
And see, oh yeah,
One of the interesting things for sure with Will, and I don't know about you, Carlos, was how he was able to get to Juilliard. And we'll talk about Juilliard in a bit, specifically the audition. But once you were admitted to Juilliard, you had to raise the money because Juilliard is incredibly expensive. And you did a GoFundMe project where you're able to raise, I think, 73,000. Was that Canadian dollars?
If it's 73, that would have been in U.S. dollars. In US Canadian dollars, okay. it was over 100.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. So how? I mean, how did that get started? Who told you to try that? And how did the letters go out and or emails or whatever?
Well, I knew I was going to have trouble. Me and my family knew we were going to have a little bit of trouble affording it. So a family friend of mine, Andre Demise, he set up the GoFundMe campaign. And he's got connections, so he was able to set me up with some TV interviews. And just like that, a lot of people all over Canada and all over the world actually started donating to the campaign and left some kind messages. I remember one person said, you know, I got into MIT back in the day and I wasn't able to afford it, so I couldn't go. So I want someone with your kind of talent to be able to go, and this person ended the message with the quote, and I remember very well word for word: spread your wings and fly, kid. So, you know, just a whole lot of generous people you know, gave some money and time into that whole campaign for me to get through my first 2 years before the Cobner Fellowship came in. And so and then on the last 2 years of my bachelor's and this year as well, Bruce and Susie Cobner have been, you know, very, very generous to and the Juilliard School to have me as a part of the fellowship as well. So that's essentially been my journey through Juilliard financially.
Yeah, wow. So the person that said spread your wings and fly, kid, did you ever have a chance to meet that person?
I didn't, unfortunately, no. Oh. I don't believe we live anywhere close.
Oh, okay. That's too
close
bad.
To each other. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great story though. And great that you would have a friend that would know how to do it. I think maybe without the TV appearances, you wouldn't have much of a chance, or at least not as good of a chance.
Right. Yeah, that's right. It was, you know, I was just really fortunate to be in that position. I'm also very fortunate to have a great friend in Andre Demise.
Yeah. Carlos, how about you?
Well, my story is, you know, slightly different. When my offer of admission came from Juilliard, I was also granted a Cobner Fellowship at that time. So again, the generosity from Bruce and Susie Cobner cannot be overstated.
That was for your first year?
That was exactly. That was offered to me for the duration of my degree at Juilliard. So all 4 years, it was comprehensive financial support through that.
Wow, that's great. I guess there are a number of schools that are really expensive, but Juilliard, I guess in American dollars is like 300 and what, $70,000 or $80,000 for a 4 year term. Is that correct? Something like that?
It's somewhere up there. I'm not exactly sure what the right number is, but that sounds more or less accurate, I think. Is Carlos doing math?
No.
Yeah, I've heard of people that have graduated. Somebody told me a doctoral student at Indiana University graduated an opera singer and didn't have a job and was like $160,000 in debt or something like that. So, I mean, it can be really tough, I think. Anyway, before we get on to Juilliard, Will, I want to ask you something specific to you. And I forget the scientific term, but you see colors for specific notes. Is that correct?
Yeah. Synesthesia. So
synesthesia. Okay.
Yeah. So I see colors for certain notes. I see letters and numbers in color as well. And there's a whole bunch of different types of synesthesia, some of which I have, some of which I don't. So scientists essentially believe that there are extra connections between neurons. And I think a part of it might be connected to my perfect pitch as well. And, you know, with perfect pitch, it comes as a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, I was going to ask, which one is that? Yeah, with synesthesia, is that a blessing or a curse?
In certain ways that it's implemented, it's a blessing. In certain ways that it's implemented, it's a curse. I find it's particular, like it makes music a whole lot more visually beautiful, but I find, particularly when I'm practicing piano, it's hard for me to count out loud while I'm playing, because sometimes I'll be instructed to do that when I was younger, and then I'm like, wait, these colors don't quite align. So I would be saying the wrong number in the right place, in the wrong place. So it's interesting, but I'm grateful that I have it anyway.
Yeah. Well, okay. So let me add, just for my interest, two pieces. So you're sitting on stage and you play the beginning of Also Sprach Zarathustra, C, G, C. When you play those notes, do you actually see colors then?
I do. And it would mostly be sort of a green that's close to turquoise, since it's mostly a C minor, C major-ish piece of music at the beginning, and the note G is purple, so that's sort of implemented in there as well.
So that actually flashes in front of your field of vision.
Sort of. It's there, but it's not really covering anything. It's not an opaque color, if that makes any sense.
Uh huh.
It's a fairly translucent experience.
Okay, and the beginning of Pictures at an Exhibition, would that be confusing because the notes go by quicker?
No, it would mostly just be the notes as they are for the most part.
So your auditions for Juilliard, they took three out of 83. And were you all in a room pretty much, or did they do it over several days? And how many people were there? And did you feel like intense pressure when you were auditioning, or was it somewhat, I don't know if you could say, relaxed?
Yeah, I think they definitely did it over more than one day. I can't quite remember what the schedule looked like, but I think I was more or less relaxed for that audition in particular. You know, there were a couple people in the warm-up room that I happened to know, and we just had a couple conversations about stuff other than trumpet. So I wasn't really thinking about the actual audition until I walked in and played and walked out. So it was a pretty cool, calm experience.
And how long did you play?
It couldn't have been more than 10 minutes. The repertoire required was just pick your solo piece, pick two contrasting etudes, and I had listed five excerpts on there, and I think they only had me, they picked the excerpts out of the five that I picked, and so they only had me play two or three of them maybe, and then that was it.
And did they say anything to you or ask you to repeat anything?
No, I don't think I was asked to repeat anything, and all comments were neutral, as I believe they're instructed to keep everything neutral and not be like, good job, or you're not good at this. So, uh-huh. You know, so that was essentially my experience. It's hard to really remember because I was in the room for less than 10 minutes. It feels like it went by so fast, and because I barely knew the players on the committee there, it was hard to really remember faces. And then after getting to meet Ray Mace and Mark Gould, it's like, I had already known Mark Gould, but I didn't know Ray Mace yet. So once I got here and met him, it was like, oh yeah, I can put that face to the memory of my audition now. So,
and how soon did you hear after the audition that they accepted you?
I think all students would have heard around the same time. Carlos, was it around early April or late April?
It was definitely Easter of 2018, around that week for me. I'm looking up exactly when that week was. But...
And when was the audition?
Maybe late March for me.
So you didn't have to wait too long.
Yeah, it wasn't a terribly long time to wait. Yeah, I think I was at a youth orchestra rehearsal when I found out.
Hey, me too.
Yeah, that's so funny. One of my sections mates was like, "Oh my god, we gotta bake you a cake."
So, how was your audition, Carlos?
My audition, I remember really well, was February 28th of 2018, and I remember that day specifically because that is the day of the regional holiday of Andalusia, where I'm from in Spain. It's like the day of the region, so. It's sort of a special day in my calendar. So that was that's the day that happened. Yeah, similarly to Will, I must have been in the room for just about 10 minutes, maybe 10 to 15, not longer than that, you know, playing something from the first and second movements of Grondahl, a couple of excerpts, and I think that was it for me. I definitely remember when I was getting ready to play Grondahl, I hadn't played any notes in the room. I just walked in, you know, looked at my pianist, we're ready to go, let's go. and I'm getting ready to play, and Michael Powell is in the room. He's part of the Juilliard faculty, and he was in the audition panel. And he waves at me and says, "Oh, if you would like to play a few notes just to, you know, get used to the room or anything, please feel free to do so." And at that point, I remember like breathing a sigh of relief, like, okay, we have time, we have room, we have space. So that definitely put me a little bit more at ease, just that little detail.
And Joe Alessi was there as well?
Oh, yeah. Joe was there, and Dr. Brevik as well, Per Brevik was in the room. They were all three of them were there.
And was that intimidating, or did they say anything? Or, yeah.
This was the first time that I had seen Joe Alessi in person.
Just when you walked into the room?
When I walked into the room, exactly. Yeah, I think I saw him in the hallway before, but like the first time sort of being in a real interaction with him was that moment.
And did he look mean, or?
He was there, you know. I think he had, you know, he had a coffee. I don't think I looked at him a lot, because I just wanted to, like, you know, do my own thing. Again, you know, yeah, I walked in, I was just like ready to play and just do the thing. But yeah, I don't remember them being specifically very intimidating in the way they interacted with me. I remember them being very supportive and very opening and inviting, all three of them.
Yeah, that's great. So when you started to study, then Joe was your main teacher or your only teacher?
He was my only private studio teacher. Yeah. And we also had, they still have trombone choir and low brass class with him. So
yeah,
tenor trombone students, the ones we studied with him, which during my time was basically all of us, except, you know, apart from small exceptions, we study a lot with him. We do a lot of hours a week with him, which is great because we get to learn from one of the best in the field.
Yeah. He's an incredible teacher and, of course, player.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, what specific things did you get that really either not just helped you, but maybe changed the way you viewed music or playing the trombone?
I definitely remember realizing really early on that I really had to work a lot. I was the only new undergraduate student for trombone that year, tenor or bass. I don't think there was any new bass trombonist student, but there were only two tenor trombone students new that year. And I was the only undergrad, the other one was a master's student. So I remember them, you know, realizing that, hey, I'm here with people that are all more experienced than me. So here's a chance to really put in the work. And I, you know, my sensation was that I had to like catch up to where everybody else was. Everybody was so good. So yeah, definitely the lessons with Joe helped me develop that grit and that focus on detail work and having something be, you know, there's always room for making things better. So I definitely, that's one of the biggest things I learned from him, for sure.
He's very big on basics too, I think, right? On fundamentals.
Oh yeah, fundamentals are definitely one of the things that I worked on the most, just getting things to be as solid as possible on the instrument, getting as much consistency and also agility and facility around the horn. Those were definitely big.
Yeah. I'm sure you've seen the video that he did. Actually, he did two videos, I think, with Phil Smith about practicing in the hotel room.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever see? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Where he's playing William Tell. And I've shown that to a number of trumpet students and trombone players. And I say, okay, this is fun, and it's funny. But look at his posture when he's playing William Tell against the hotel wall. I mean, that's the way you have to stand when you're playing trombone. I mean, that's like the perfect position. And even when he's doing something that's funny, it's like he has to do it the right way, you know? So that sort of perfection in the way he approaches things is great.
I think that's a really good way to put it. And I did, once I started being more interested in things like the Alexander technique, I started paying more attention to how he, you know, organizes himself when he plays, and just seeing him in a lesson every week, being like, every time, like you say, no matter what he was going to play, be it loud, soft, whatever it is, he really had, you know, and still has as like a great organization of the whole, everything that he puts into it, not just the body, but his attitude around playing is just amazing to have had the chance to be around that for so long.
Actually, Ray Mason, I played in a group with him called Summit Brass, and we used to do this piece of mine called Music for Brass Octet, not a very original title, but it had two antiphonal groups of four. And there was one place in the second movement where there's a chord cluster, it towards the end of the movement, and it sort of ends, and the first trombone has an F top part of the staff piano or pianissimo, I forget, quite soft, and then people gradually start to come in. We did that many, many times, and it was, you know, Joe was always perfect on that note, you know, no big deal, it was always right there. And there was this one concert, and it was a Sunday afternoon concert, not a big deal concert, sort of, but it came to that part, and he played that note, and I remember thinking to myself, that's the most perfect note I have ever heard played in my life. There was just something about it. And we went on to the last movement, and the last movement ends up, it gets faster and faster, louder and louder. And so by the end of the piece, I had totally forgotten about it. And then during the intermission, Ray Mace came up to me and he said, did you hear that note of Joe's? So it was not just me. It was, you know, there's something very special about when he plays that is just, he's right in the middle of every note. So, Will, speaking of Ray Mace, you studied with Ray, I think, your fourth year, and Chris Martin, your first through third year. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And I still study with both Chris and Ray now.
And Chris is mainly orchestral excerpts or fundamentals, etudes, the whole bag?
I can kind of take any piece of music to both teachers, honestly. But Chris happened to be the one who was very, very helpful for me in my 3 years with all of my fundamentals and excerpt solos, everything. So the reason why I started studying with Ray as well is I had gotten into the five-year program, and I figured, well, I still got a lot of time left at Juilliard, so I might as well, you know, I'd probably be pretty stupid not to study with Ray as well and not kind of get his opinion on everything that I'm doing on the horn. I started doing half my lessons with Chris and half my lessons with Ray my fourth year, and just going back and forth, seeing Chris 1 week, seeing Ray another week, really helped me to put some more playing concepts together, musical concepts together, and pretty much everything together, so I could kind of take this from over here, take that from over here, and just use my own glue. Vince Penzarella used to talk about taking this and that from this player and using Penzarella glue. So I just take this and that.
Okay. And
I just take that and this and that and use Leathers glue and put it all together into the player I want to be. And so that's essentially what I had the freedom of doing with both teachers being at that point. And I think that really contributed to me being able to finally start winning auditions.
What would you see as similarities of the two and differences between the two in their approach maybe to teaching and music?
I don't know how to actually pick similarities. I've just kind of thought of them as two different human beings that I'm going to for teaching and guidance and all that. So I don't know, but I notice a lot more differences than similarities. I mean, they both, like, I guess you can sort of classify them as both New York style players with similar sound concepts in their playing, but other than that, they've offered musical opinions and fundamental advice. It's really hard to put together some similarities in my head because I've never actually thought about
that before.
Funny enough,
what about differences?
I find that every time I took a piece of music to Chris, there would be a whole lot of focus on emphasis and more fatness on the lower notes. That's one thing. Chris is all about ping attacks and getting my sound even throughout all registers. And Ray was definitely a lot more concerned about my musicality. And I think Chris got a lot of good music flowing through me, starting with fundamentals and then working through musical choices. And then Ray was pretty much the other way around. And still is, you know, still studying with the both of them. Ray always makes musical comments first, and if he feels like he needs to, he'll make a fundamental comment as well. It's almost like when I study with one teacher, when I take a lesson with one teacher and go to the other, it's almost like the lesson is working in reverse.
Yeah,
which is really cool.
That is great. When I played in Summit with Ray, I'd always, we played some pretty difficult concerts. I'd always, not always, but quite often, I think I'd be going on stage thinking, don't screw up, you know, don't make mistakes. And Ray all the time was, he'd go on stage and just play music and just take chances, you know, and I really admired that in him. You know, wish I had more of that quality myself of just thinking what he wanted to do musically and then going out and trying to do it, you know. A really complete musician too, you know, that he can play orchestras and quintets, and he can play cornetto and
oh yeah, absolutely, that, he can know? Do anything.
I don't think he can play jazz really, but did you take jazz lessons when you were there?
I did. I took some jazz lessons with Tatum Greenblatt.
Okay, and Carlos, do you play jazz?
Never with any sort of seriousness. I never took lessons or anything like that. So no, pretty much just a classically oriented player.
Join Tony, Carlos, and Will in part two, where they continue their conversation about some of their experiences at Juilliard. They then move on to their current jobs as principal trumpet with the Nashville Symphony and principal trombone with the New York City Ballet. And they talk some about what they experienced during their auditions. Thank you for listening. And if you're enjoying these interviews, please subscribe to the podcast and help us spread the word.